Good morning and welcome to this episode of Step Into the Light. I am your host, Patty Sheen. Thank you for listening. On this show, we introduce listeners to people who have found their way out of the dark shadows of life and back to light, and those who, through various ministries and creative endeavors, lead others on their journey from darkness to light. Good morning again and welcome. My guest today, Lisa Hatfield, is an author who shares emergency preparedness ideas so people will be ready for natural and family disasters and also be able to help themselves and others in the middle of chaos. Lisa's passion is to be a blessing to other people. Her novel, To Starve and Ember, is about wildfires and family disasters and is book one of the Ready to Go series. Good morning, Lisa. Welcome to Step Into the Light.
Good morning, Patty.
It's a blessing to have you here, Lisa. You sent your book to me quite a while ago, and I got to reading it, and things got crazy in my life. And in fact, it just so happened that I was watching the news the other night, in fact, and they were talking about this being National Fire Prevention Month. I thought, oh, my goodness, I've got to get Lisa on the show before the end of the month is over. And I was thinking to myself, gee, aren't we about done with wildfires? And would you believe I turned on the news last night and sure as heck, here's another wildfire right up there in Colorado Springs last night. So we are definitely not at the end of wildfire season. It is still an imminent threat to people. So tell us what motivated your interest in firefighting and wildfires in general.
Well, I first moved here from the Midwest, and so I didn't know what wildfires were. And the first wildfire I saw was actually burning right toward our house as my husband and I sat out on our deck eating lunch. And it was a grass fire. It was in 2001. And we didn't even call 911. We just watched it. And when we said, gee, that looks like a wildfire. And eventually we thought, maybe we should call somebody. But by then the fire trucks had arrived. And so that shows you where I started. But since then we've had so many wildfires just within sight of my house, the Hayman fire, the Waldo Canyon fire, the Black Forest fire, and then more recently in 2021, that summer, we had the three biggest fires that have ever occurred in Colorado all in the same summer. They took the three top spots on the list. And what made me so interested, I don't understand why everybody's not interested. We all the people who live around me could be learning the same things I've been learning since all these events have happened. But for some reason, I've been just paying a lot of attention and trying to learn from the firefighters about what we can do differently.
That's very interesting, Lisa. So you're not telling me that, oh, my dad was a firefighter for 30 years, or I'm married to a firefighter. Or no, you just saw this environmental threat and you said, wow, I want to do something about this. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah, it took me a while after that first one in 2001, but then when the Waldo Canyon fire was burning, it was burning up on the mountain above Colorado Springs, and so I bet 500,000 people could see it burning at night, and you'd see big flashes of light as different houses caught fire and made big fire explosions. And
sure.
I was miles away in Monument, but I still had ash landing on my deck as a lot of other people did too. And then it just was like, wow, this, I've got to pay more attention now. And then that fall, we were able to form a group at my church called the Emergency Preparedness Group, which was after some training we got from the Office of Emergency Management, which was really just about general emergency preparedness, not specifically wildfires yet, but that was part of the idea. And then the next summer, we had the Black Forest fire, which was even closer to us in Monument. It was it's a 10-minute drive to get to where the fire was burning. And
wow,
that then once, that was just, you know, in itself, we were all on pre-evacuation, and nobody in our group lost their home, but we knew more people that lost homes in that fire. And then It was by the grace of God. We got connected with a man named Byron Spinney, who runs a disaster ministry called Hope Restored, and he does a chainsaw ministry. He'll jump in his truck with, you know, no notice at all and drive. Just recently, he drove to Florida with his chainsaw to help clean up after the hurricane. And he'll drive anywhere and help anybody. And he shares the gospel with everybody he talks to. And he also taught us how to safely work on a work site with chainsaws, doing the cleanup, making things look sorted, you know, dealt with, even if they're not all the way done, to help the emotional side of the people who own the property. One of the biggest mistakes we made when we started going in to help after the Black Forest fire was, initially, sometimes people would be there on the property and we would well-meaningly say, "Oh, are you the homeowner?" When in fact, we should not say that. We should say, "Are you the property owner?" Because at that point, there was no home left on the property. And he helped teach us things like that so that we wouldn't step all over ourselves, you know, and make it worse for them.
Sure.
Our point was to go there and help them, not add to their emotional grief, you know. But
right.
So he was an amazing influence on us. And then we went off on our own after that, but we frequently team up with his group even now, 10 years later, to do work projects sometimes when we need to back each other up. Because we're out there doing the same thing. What we're trying to do is show people will take care of other people just because we love them and it's the right thing to do. And we want to show how God's love has filled us up to overflowing, and we want to come out and help, even if it means taking all day and running a chipper and getting all covered with soot. And not, you know, we never charged them any money, and they would always say, "Oh, are you, you know, how can you do this for free?" And the point was, because we're trying to do what Jesus would do. We always imagine, you know, Jesus wearing his chainsaw chaps and his leather boots, you know, and it's just been such a growth experience for me. But I always have to watch that, because they always say, you know, when you go on a mission trip, it's not about you. You're supposed to be helping the people you're there to help. And so I have learned so much, but on the days we're there, we have to focus on what they need and how to do the right work for the people that day. And it's been amazing to meet all the different kinds of people out there who needed our help.
Wow. But, you know, Lisa, I haven't heard of a single person that has ever went on a mission trip that doesn't come back having experienced some kind of growth to some degree, spiritual growth or growth in their relationship skills or just acquired new skills of a different nature. So I think that you're very right in that, yes, you're there to help those other people, but I think that God also uses that opportunity to grow us as well,
mm-hmm.
as those who,
yes.
Who are serving on those mission trips. Oh, that sounds really, really wonderful. What an amazing ministry you guys have.
I've had a couple of really neat experiences as part of being with this group. It's, you know, you can talk about it all day. Oh, you're supposed to put God first. But if you're in your office reading a book about it, we're like, well, of course I'm going to put God first. But if you're outside all by yourself in a parking lot trying to hook up a trailer, and it's 6:30 in the morning and everybody's waiting for you and it won't work.
Yeah.
That's when I've had some really cool experiences when that happened to me, I was getting so frustrated because I knew how to do it and it just wasn't working. And so I ended up sitting down on the ground, looking up at the beautiful Colorado blue sky. And for the first time I noticed that our church actually has a cross on top, which I hadn't noticed before because it's kind of a modern church. And I said, "God, mm-hmm. I need some help." And, you know, within a minute, this guy drove up to the parking lot, completely empty parking lot, on a Saturday morning, and he was wearing an orange shirt like I was. And I didn't even ask him who he was. I said, "Can you help me hook up this trailer?" And he did. And then as it turns out, he was trying to join our group that day, and he showed up really at the wrong place. Everybody else was supposed to be meeting somewhere else. But so many things like that have happened where I had to just give in first before I could have the experience God wanted me to have, you know, and just trust him.
Yeah. And that's sometimes the way it works out. Lisa, we're going to talk about your book in a while, but I wanted to bring up that you talked about some of the myths that people believe about fire behavior. Could you share a little bit of that with us?
Sure. I think the biggest misconception is that when wildfires come along, what really does the damage is this gigantic wall of flames that's devouring everything in its path. And the truth is, 80% of homes that are destroyed in relation to a wildfire are destroyed by the flying embers that blow ahead of the fire and land on things. And, you know, embers like that look like the coals in your barbecue grill or a campfire. They can be as small as a little spark that, you know, to a person, it might just seem like a pesky little spark, but if it lands in the right type of fine, dry fuels, like dry leaves under your front steps, or the embers can be so big as a loaf of bread, depending on how strong the hot wind is, it can loft these gigantic burning briquettes. And if those land on your roof or in your yard, then they can smolder or they can sneak inside your house through the nooks and crannies in your house. We call them the chinks in your armor. And it could catch the house on fire, but it might take a while. So even if you have a fire crew there watching for hot spots, trying to stop the fire from coming, if the fire is just smoldering for hours and doesn't really ignite until later when the firefighters have gone by to the next area, that's what really causes the damage and destroys the homes. But the amazing part about that is there are things you can do to make it less likely your house will catch fire from a flying ember.
Yes, talk to us about them.
So you just have to think about what does fire need to exist? It needs fuel, oxygen, and heat. And if you take away any of those three things, then the fire can't survive. So if this burning ember lands in your yard, it's going to start to look for fuel. And that means anything that's flammable, leaves, grass, your roof, your trampoline, the foam cushions on your deck, anything. And what's good about that is that if you can take control of what that fuel is right around your house, the scientists have studied how the embers work and what happens. And what they've shown is that if you have those first 0 to 5 feet from your house should be no fuel at all, no mulch, no foam cushions on your patio furniture, no dry leaves up against the house. Just bare earth is good or rock is okay, but just don't let the pine needles pile up there and don't store lumber there. And then the next 30 feet out from your house, you don't have to have nothing. We don't talk about clear cutting, but what we do talk about is vegetation management. So if you live in an area where there are a lot of pine trees, for example, make sure they're not all crowded together. We've inherited a problem. We've grown up in a society that really doesn't understand about vegetation management or wildfires. And so what we haven't done is let the fires come through, but we also haven't thinned out the trees. So we have about the density of trees is like 10 times as dense as it ought to be in some places. And so we need to make them more healthy. If we thin them out, it's like when you grow carrots and you plant all the seeds, but then you take out a lot of the ones that are sprouted to make the other carrots more healthy. The same with the trees. And then if you have scrub oak or other kinds of vegetation, you want to make it so that the fuel around your house is discontinuous. And that means like put it in a mosaic pattern instead of in a way that the fuel could draw the fire right towards your house if it's burning towards you. And then the other thing they talk about is this concept called home hardening, where that makes you think about what your home itself is made out of. Do you have a wood shake roof? That's the biggest risk you have right there. Do you have wood siding? And if so, is it all dried out? Or do you keep it stained and fresh so that it would resist ignition? Stuff like that. There are things you can do to make it safer, make it less likely for your house to ignite when there are embers blown through the air and landing nearby in what we call the defensible space. When we call it the defensible space, it's not because you're standing there defending it. And there might not even be a firefighter standing there defending it. Nobody should be there at that time when the fire is coming. what we hope you'll do if a fire is coming is that you'll get out of there, get to someplace safe, and know that you've done the work you can do on your house beforehand. So when you leave, your house can defend itself.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Well, speaking of roofs, Lisa, I thought I'd throw this question out since I have one. What is the feeling about a metal roof?
Metal roofs are awesome. We have owned 2 metal roofs ourselves, and our insurance company also thinks they're awesome. Sometimes people might be concerned that they would be noisy, and in fact, they're not. And metal is great at being, you know, it's not fuel at all for the embers. If it lands on there, the embers will just starve to death and go out. So that's a good thing.
Okay. The only concern I have is that I've heard if a fire starts inside your home, that it is going to be, I don't know, that much more intense because it can't get out of a metal roof. Do you understand what I'm saying? Am I making it clear that, I mean, you know, I've heard that too. And I thought, oh, great. But on the other hand, if there's a fire
exactly
in your home, hopefully you're going to get the heck out. You're not going to be worried about how hot it's burning. You're going to get out of there. So I just thought I'd run that by you and see what your thoughts are.
One of the things I teach in the CERT class now is home hazards and how to shut off your utilities and how to use fire extinguishers. And one of the immediate things we show is the video of how fast a fire takes over a room, especially with the materials that tend to be used inside homes now, carpeting and furniture, the smoke that is, you just can't mess with it. It's not just like a nice little wood fire anymore. It's a toxic mess, and you really do need to just get out right away. Anything about a metal roof versus a wood roof, that's more in the territory that a firefighter would care about. But as a regular civilian, your job is to just get yourself and your loved ones outside to safety and call 911.
Okay, very good. Well, thank you for answering that question because I had heard different. I was always pleased that I had a metal roof, actually. I intentionally got one when I had to have my roofing redone because I had heard good things about it. So I'm glad that you are in agreement with me there. We'll take a break here where I remind listeners that you are listening to Step Into the Light with host Patty Sheen right here on Blog Talk Radio. My guest is author Lisa Hatfield. Lisa is the author of To Starve an Ember, an adventure story about a wildfire that also carries a deeper message. If you would like to listen to this episode again or hopefully refer it to friends and family, it is on archive. The most current 5 episodes can be found on the homepage at pattysheen.com. That's spelled PattySheen.com. The Blog Talk Radio tab at the top of the page will give access to all the episodes we have aired to date. Under each episode is a More Information tab that provides links to guest websites, social media, and other resource information. Let's return to our interview. Well, how do you reach a community, Lisa, to educate them about wildfire risk reduction? What ways do you use to make people aware of, hey, this is something that is really a concern here?
Mm-hmm. That is the question of the decade, of the century, because I have participated with so many fire departments and the Colorado State Forest Service and our church group and our HOA to sponsor events that are informational so people can come and just learn more about wildfires. And my overall experience is that nobody wants to think about it. And it's too bad because if they would come and listen, they would hear what you've just heard and know that they don't have to be fatalistic. There are ways they can be good stewards of their vegetation on their land. They can be good stewards of their home but by just doing the regular maintenance. But anyway, so we've all those groups that I'm with, we've tried lots of different ways to get the word out to people. We do outreach at the El Paso County Fair and at the fire department. We'll have little open houses. And now during the pandemic, we did Zoom meetings about it. A new idea that we've been using with my church group is we did a whole Zoom class series, and it talks about your individual property, what you can do on your property. But then we bundle that together with, so what does your whole neighborhood look like? Is your whole neighborhood at great risk? And should you and all your neighbors be working on this and doing it together? And that makes it more fun and more easy. So we've taught a class called Neighborhood Ambassadors, where we've had about 30 representatives from about 30 neighborhoods come through the class, and we'll teach them all the points we've learned in the 10 or 12 years since we've been learning about how to do a rolling chipping day with a big chipper and get rid of all that slash, and how to help communicate with your neighbors, and how to, what their usual objections are, what are they usually worried about, what we teach them to do is what we call a rolling chipping day, or maybe a day where everybody gathers all their slash from their yards and puts it in dumpsters and gets it hauled away. But then everybody turns it into a group experience. So then afterwards you can have a potluck dinner and really get to know all your neighbors. So many times
kind of
we have work.
Time.
Yeah.
Make it,
but
yeah.
Many times when we've been in neighborhoods, people who live across the street from each other will hear that sound of that chipper and come outside wondering what's going on and introduce themselves to people that they've lived across the street from for years. And that's the first day they've actually talked to each other. So we feel like it's a really important ministry that way too, just to get people communicating.
Exactly.
And then in desperation though, I was like, this is, you know, we have Fire Rice Day every year. We try all these things and, you know, the same four people show up. So I thought, what if I wrote a novel and I'll sneak in all these principles about what I've just been talking about, but I'll put them in the form of an entertaining novel that you can't put down and has a whole storyline about the internal development of our main character, who's a firefighter, and he has trouble with his relationship with his dad. And then he meets this neat young lady who gives him a whole new perspective on how to approach his relationships. So I've got a story of a wildfire burning intertwined with him trying to deal with these, what I call the internal smoldering embers of his past relationship with his dad. And so I'm trying to make it more like I'm going to sneak up on people and teach them something that way this time.
I love it. And for listeners, the result of that is your novel titled To Starve an Ember.
And the way I hope by now those of you who are listening understand what that title means. If you starve the embers of their fuel, then they'll go out and they won't burn down your house. And those smoldering embers inside your soul that you haven't dealt with, if you take away their fuel by opening up the communication with whoever it is that you need to do it with and learning how to ask for help, then that fire will go out too and you'll have a much happier life and more fulfilling life.
If you starve those embers of bitterness and unforgiveness and all those things, that resentment and just all those different things that build up in our lives that we don't want to deal with or we don't deal with, and it becomes toxic to us, just like embers in a fire become toxic to the fuel that it ignites. Very good. Where can readers find your book and listeners?
This sounds like a very simple question, but I'm so proud of my answer. It can be found at fine bookstores everywhere. And I mean,
wonderful.
It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and every place you click these days. I am so happy to say that with the help from my mentors, some of whom I met at American Christian Fiction Writers Group, Gordon Saunders, he helped me so much. He encouraged me to make my own audiobook. So while it's not an Hollywood production by any means, it is an audio version of the book, so you can listen to it while you're walking or driving instead of picking up a printed copy or an e-book copy. It's even available at Pikes Peak Library District. All three versions are. From that point of view, I'm really, really stoked.
Well, absolutely, that's wonderful, Lisa. And I wonder, there's got to be, I know, like down here where I live, our fire department is voluntary, but I'm sure that there are paid fire departments throughout the country that deal with wildfires, and I wonder if there's a way that you could connect with those people and say, hey, I have this book, you know? I'm not very good at marketing, but it's just an idea.
Yeah, one of the goals of writing this book was what I've been telling people is I think this book can save lives and property. And I'm not just talking about the lives of the people who live in the house. I'm also talking about the lives of the firefighters. Because what another misconception is that you're going to have a fire truck in front of your house during a wildfire. But if you think about how many people live in whatever community you're in and how many fire trucks you have, the math just doesn't work out. And the firefighters have to make a decision. When they're driving up your street, do they see a street that's there where they can see each house as they drive by? They know where there are houses even on the street. They can see that people have been keeping their vegetation maintained, and they're making it possible for the firefighters to do their job. Or do they see a tangle of scrub oak and little baby pine trees and big pine trees and fallen stuff? And there are so many neighborhoods where you can't even see where the houses are. And unfortunately, the firefighters, when they get to a place like that, they've got to make a decision and say, no, we cannot hold the line here. We're going to move on to the next street or the next neighborhood.
Right. Wow.
And some people were caught by surprise last year by the Marshall Fire up near Boulder, because it was a wildfire, but it was in, there weren't a lot of trees there, and it was quote, just a grass fire. And but it really did so much destruction, and it burned so fast. Now, in that case, you know, the winds were just burning, going like crazy. And it was in the middle of winter, too, as that took people by surprise, too. But the truth is, fire season is all year round now. It doesn't really end, because we've got so much fuel everywhere. Those houses, because they were so close together, the houses themselves are the fuel causing the problem for the next house over. And that was a big wake-up call for a lot of people, that even though it looks like an urban area, they're still at the risk. They're so close to what we call the wildland-urban interface that the risk factors are higher than they had learned about. So that was a really hard one, though. That was hard. The one I'm thinking of right now was the Marshall Fire, and it burned Superior and Louisville, Colorado.
Even down here in southeastern Colorado, where I am, we're up on the plains. I'm in Colorado, but not anywhere near the mountains, I tell people. We usually have a fire that breaks out on our river bottom every single year. And sometimes they're out within a day or so, and sometimes they burn for a couple of weeks before they get them under control. In fact, one of our firefighters lost his home in this last fire that we had.
Yeah. There was one called the Mile Marker 117 fire that ignited because of sparks from a truck that was dragging its chains on the interstate. And that one was just grassland. And 25 homes were lost there. And the amazing thing was the chance of the home surviving was significantly better for the homes where people had kept their grass mowed around their house.
Yeah, and it doesn't take that much to go ahead and initiate those kinds of preventative measures if a person would just think about it.
Yep.
Lisa, what I wanted to mention earlier, of course, I've read your book, and I guess I didn't check it out, but this www.tinderboxtips website is a real website, I assume.
Oh, you caught me on that one. I do own the website. I haven't populated it yet. So far, all the tips are all just listed inside the novel. But when anything settles down here, I'm planning on creating, going ahead and populating that website. In the meantime, I didn't want anybody else to buy it anyway. So, but on my regular website, which is lisahatfieldwriter.com, I have not all those tips, but I have some videos that people can learn from, and just some different observations about ways of dealing with disasters in your life, whether it be natural disasters or family disasters. I give just hints on there, but what I was trying to do was just introduce people to me and how it's not just natural disasters that cause the trouble. And so, like in this first book, I talked a lot about this dysfunctional relationship with Prentice and his dad, where they just hadn't learned how to set the rules with each other. It wasn't fair at all, but it was because the dad had grown up in a dysfunctional environment too. And there's a generational thing there where they call it the flames of family dysfunction. And what do you do about that? Can you turn around and make a stand in your generation and and make the relationship healthier. When I get into my other novels, the next one is going to feature a blizzard, and then the third one's we're gonna go back in time to Hurricane Katrina, and visit one of our characters, Jessie. We're gonna see her as a middle school girl dealing with her dysfunctional family. But I just the reason I'm putting all that in there is I'm not just whining and moaning about it. I'm showing how there are resources you can get to help you deal with those kinds of things that are not going well for you either, that aren't healthy for you. And so I encourage people to check those out too. I'm really proud of, I got to say pride of most novels don't have a pages of resources at the back, but I've got about 4 pages of research that I did to help people. So if you're interested in any of the topics in the book, you can look in the references.
Oh, very good, Lisa. Well, yeah, you know, natural disasters are something that we're always going to be living with. And there are ways to protect yourself. Even though sometimes you get short notice of what's going on, there are still ways, just like you brought up with all of the fire mitigation issues here, that there are ways to prevent yourself from being injured or hopefully your property. Sometimes you can't. I realize that too. But
yeah,
I think what you're doing here is just really great. And yes, I love the way that you relate. How many times, Lisa, how many books are there written about the storms of life and how we have to weather the storms of life? And it doesn't necessarily mean a hurricane. It means turmoil that is going on in your life, whether it be with relationships or marriage or kids or job or whatever. So, yeah, I think you just have a wonderful platform here.
Well, I really hope to help people. And I have a little newsletter that I send out very intermittently, but if anybody is interested in finding out more about what I'm doing or what's coming up and even get to vote on the titles of the next books and things like that, if they go to my website, it's lisahatfieldwriter.com, and there are a couple of different places where you can sign up for my newsletter. And when you do that, I'll send you a free short story that's called, and now you get the significance of this, it's called Just a Little Grass Fire. And it tells about the actual fire that burns in the novel. It's funny, somehow the way I wrote it, I didn't actually talk about when the fire started in the novel. By the time we see it there, it's already burning. So it's a sneak peek that you get to see how that fire actually started if you take a look at my website.
Oh, neat. Okay. Oh, I don't want to give too much of the book away, but you mentioned popcorn. I'll put it that way. You mentioned popcorn in your story. I can remember when I was a kid, there were 4 of us. We were like old enough to be by ourselves, you know, we were making popcorn and we had a pan on the stove and the popcorn, it was long before microwaves were even invented. So we were doing this with a pot on the stove like you did back in the old days. You're probably too young to even remember that. But anyway, the person who was cooking the popcorn took the top off of the pan and I don't know, I guess there was some butter around the edge of the pan or something. All of a sudden, the whole pan was on fire. And, you know, we all freaked out and went running outside screaming at the top of our lungs. It didn't go very far, but still, I could kind of understand when I read that scenario. It brought back that memory.
Well, that actually did happen to me. I was the one with the babysitter who broke the rules and messed things up for us there. And so just about every example in this book that you read a detail and you go, no way, I didn't make anything up. These are all real stories, real details.
Yeah. Well, I know what I was going to say. When this tinderbox tips, one of the things that I thought was interesting that you address here, it says wind currents tend to travel uphill, superheating the fuel sources above. Fire doubles in speed for every 10 degrees increase in slope. I did not know that.
Right, I forgot to mention that one before. Yeah, so if you're on a flat property, you have a little bit less to worry about than if you're on a really steep property where the fire would tend to want to burn uphill towards your house.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I always assumed that the flatter the ground is, the more you're in real danger. Well, again, like you said at the beginning of the interview, though, you said that the average person thinks about this wall of fire being the most danger, and it's really not. It's the embers that are landing in fuel that are really the most dangerous. So there you go.
Yeah, it's just information. Well, the more information you have, you know, knowledge is power, and it'll help you make decisions as you're deciding what yard work to do this weekend. Maybe you'll rake out the pine needles underneath your front steps or clean out your gutters. start there and work out from there.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, I agree with you. Well, Lisa, is there anything else that you would like to talk about that you're thinking, gee, I wish Patty had asked me that question, and she just didn't?
I hope everybody's pleasantly surprised at how much energy and is packed into this book. It kind of took me by surprise when I wrote it, but everybody I've talked to says, you know, I started reading it, and I was just going to take a look at it, and then I couldn't sleep until 3 o'clock in the morning because I was reading your book, and that makes me so happy because it means people are really paying attention and maybe they're going to learn something. And I just want to – this is my way of trying to bless other people with, you know, a blessing is something you're not expecting. And so I wasn't expecting to learn about wildfires and what I can do about them, but okay. Maybe I can help save some lives and property in the future. And I know the fire departments are glad. I know the Forest Service is glad with the message I'm putting out. I've been endorsed by them, and I hope to spread it some more in a good way.
Well, I think you certainly have done that, Lisa, and I want to thank you for sending me a copy of the book and for taking the time to interview with me today and to bless listeners with your message. All that you've said today has been most interesting and most informative, so thanks. May God continue to bless you as you write your next books, and maybe we'll have you back again when one of them is done. So until next time, God bless you.
Same to you, Patty. That's wonderful.
Listeners, in closing, we all encounter dark periods in our lives to one degree or another. During those difficult times, strive to seek the light, knowing that when we allow it to shine through, it is so much brighter than we remembered. Thank you so much for listening today. If you would like to listen to this show again, it is on archive. Go to my website, which is pattysheene.com. That's spelled pattisheene.com. The most current 5 episodes are found right on the home page. You'll find the Blog Talk Radio tab at the top of the page. Click on that. It will give you a link to all the shows we have aired to date. Under each show is a more information tab. Click on that and you will find more information about our guests, such as website and social media contacts. I can also be found on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Pinterest as Patty Sheene. Until next time, God bless you.